We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover today with a lot of events coming up at the end. So
yeah, get your pencil and paper ready, to coin a phrase.
Yeah. I used to say that every week.
Yeah, they gave up on that. Maybe they got complaints, or maybe people finally got their pencil and paper.
All right. Well, it sounds like
people have PDAs now.
It sounds like a band name, but first item is the Short Haul Truckers.
Yeah, the Short Haul Truckers.
Their first album was great.
A bunch of short haul truckers, about 200 of them, went on strike this week at the Port of Seattle. About 200 drivers refused to make deliveries to the BNSF railway yard. They're protesting the low pay that's given to short haul truckers. Short haul truckers, unlike long haul truckers, are not part of a union. They're paid like piecework. They're paid about 40 to 44 bucks per load to haul small containers and small items from the port. They have to cover all of their own costs, which includes truck payments, insurance payments, maintenance on their trucks, as well as use that money in order to try to get by. And they're protesting working conditions, particularly at the ports where they're not allowed to use port restrooms and where they're often discriminated against. Some of them it's verbal discrimination. Some of it's just plain harassment. A lot of short haul truckers in the city are East African immigrants, which contributes some to the problem because their English is not so good. So they're often a target. Particularly for verbal discrimination. The Teamsters Union is right now trying to organize them and is having some success. But in the meantime, a legislative bill, House Bill 2527, is being proposed in the state legislature, which would make shipping companies responsible for defects in the chassis and containers instead of the truckers themselves, to try to help with some of the working conditions for short-haul truckers. But in the meantime, their pay in particular, and as well as their working conditions, are continuing to be pretty miserable. So this strike has been a long time coming, and it is definitely good news for them, particularly if it has some effect on their pay and working conditions.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right, let's move on. And liquor prices.
Yeah, the Seattle Times did a review of applications by businesses with the state liquor board to sell liquor once the privatization of liquor in the state of Washington kicks in sometime in June. And after reviewing the applications, the Seattle Times concluded that, gosh, liquor prices are going to go up. Well, didn't we tell you?
Well, didn't the Seattle Times claim the opposite?
Yes.
The run up to the,
oh,
to the
you
election?
Know. You know, it's the same thing. Folks who are adamant about privatizing everything always insist that with more privatization, you have more competition, therefore prices will fall. Well, that's a theory. The theory doesn't take into account some of the real world issues that come with privatization, including the fact that the state is always going to tax liquor. It's part of our sin taxes that we use in order to make up the budget. It's always going to tax liquor, so there's a fee on top of the actual costs that the wholesalers have, and that when you add a layer of privatization at the retail level, you're going to have another company in there that needs to make a profit. That's going to jack up prices. That's the real world, folks. Privatization does not always bring prices down.
Well, and not only that, but you have no incentive, particularly on the part of state, if the market will bear higher prices, even though that's not part of the cost, the state won't necessarily charge them, and private retailers will.
Yeah. Yeah, the state won't necessarily pass on higher prices the way because the state has an incentive to make sure that the volume stays the same. They won't necessarily pass on the higher prices, whereas a private company has to in order to pay its shareholders or to make a profit for its employees and its owner.
All right. So people need to stack up now.
And don't drink it all at once.
Well, in fact, that's actually happening. A lot of small stores and a lot of restaurants, they're seeing that price increase coming down the line, and they're going to state liquor stores, and they're stocking up.
Yeah, I understand. For the restaurants, it kicks in March 1st.
June 1st. People who want to buy at retail out of a store, it's going to be June 1st.
All right. Let's move on, heading down to what's happened in Olympia this week with the state legislature.
Yeah, some bills passing or being proposed in the state legislature. First off, the Senate this week passed the gay marriage bill by a large margin. It wasn't just 25 or 26 votes to 24. It was 28 to 21. Four Republicans voted for the bill, and let's just give props to Republican Andy Hill of Redmond, Joe Fain of Auburn, Steve Litzow of Mercer Island, and Cheryl Flug of Maple Valley. Three Democrats, unfortunately, belong in the Hall of Shame. They voted against: Tim Shelton of Potlatch, Paul Shin of Edmonds, and Jim Hargrove of Hoquiam. The bill as it stands would specify that marriage is between two persons rather than one man and one woman, as it formerly said. It would allow couples from other states with valid civil unions or domestic partnerships to come to the state of Washington and get married here. The House will almost certainly pass the bill. There's lots of support for it in the House, and the governor has said that she will sign it.
And the main person who is responsible for its passing in the Senate, Senator Ed Murray of Seattle, who has been introducing this bill every year for the last 7 years, announced this week upon passage of the bill that he and his longtime partner are getting married. So,
yeah, so congratulations.
Good work to Senator Murray, and congratulations to him as well.
Now, once the governor signs the bill, opponents of the bill have said that they will file an initiative to repeal it as soon as the governor signs it. Now, they would have to collect about 120,577 signatures within 90 days of when the governor signs the bill. If they fail to collect enough signatures and qualify the initiative for the ballot, then weddings could start in June. So Murray is probably planning for a June wedding, I'm guessing, which is, you know, the usual time for brides and grooms to...
It's traditional.
Yes, it is traditional. If they fail to get enough signatures for it to go on the ballot, weddings would start in June. If they do get enough signatures for the initiative to qualify for the ballot, then the law would be suspended. It would not take effect until after the election if the initiative is voted down. If Washington becomes a state that allows gay marriage, we would be the seventh state in the union after Connecticut, Iowa, Massachusetts, New York, New Hampshire, Vermont, and the District of Columbia.
All right. Other stuff that happened on Olympia this week?
Yeah. Representative Reuven Carlisle of Seattle, he's a Democrat, he introduced a bill this week to end about 251 tax exemptions, to put an expiration date on them. And his bill, House Bill 2761, would exempt the tax break on food, tax break on medicine, and any breaks on employee wages, and ones that are required by the state constitution or are part of an existing legal agreement or that prevent double taxation. So what he's essentially saying is it's easy for the state legislature to pass tax breaks, to just hand them out with a simple majority. Most of them are passed without any kind of a sunset or any kind of an expiration date. This bill would put an expiration date on them and force the state legislature to have those come up for a vote again, to look at them in committee and say, is this really worthwhile? Are we getting a bang for our buck here, or should we be collecting those bucks?
So props to Representative Carlisle on that. Also this week, there was a hearing on Senator Gene Colwell's bill to require in-person ID ads for escort ads. Now, this is being popularly referred to as the Backpages.com bill, after the Village Voice Media and Seattle Weekly website that has been tied to a lot of child prostitution, especially in the Seattle area. And as part of that testimony this week, Mayor Mike McGinn testified, and also City Council. He got in trouble, remember, for pulling his administration and the city's advertising from Seattle Weekly over the flap. Also, City Council member Tim Burgess testified and released a report on 3.5 years of King County prosecution data, which found that over those 3.5 years, 67 people victimized more than 78 girls and women in King County. Three quarters of those girls and women were juveniles, with a sizable number, that's the exact phrase used, of them between 13 and 15 years of age. So we finally have some hard data to go with the allegations that this has been going on, and that ID is not being checked in these escort ads, particularly by the fine folks at the Weekly and Backpages.com. But it would cover not just Backpages, but also any other websites that might pop up that want to trade in the same sort of same sort of sleaze.
Yeah, and I think it kind of puts a hole in that whole argument that, well, if you make these folks check IDs, that's limiting free speech, et cetera, et cetera. Free speech when it involves a federal crime, I don't think so.
Yeah, yeah. Advertising a federal crime is not a free speech issue.
Is not a free speech issue, no.
Also nationally, there were a lot of, just sort of looking around the inner tubes this week, there were a lot of really stupid things being proposed at the state legislative level in a lot of different parts of the country. But, my favorite response to them in a long, long time, happened this week in Virginia, where, a Virginia senator named Janet Howell, somewhat annoyed by a bill there, and this has popped up in other states there, that would require women to have an ultrasound before they could have an abortion. So she attached an amendment to this bill that would require men to undergo a rectal exam and a cardiac stress test before they can be prescribed medication for erectile dysfunction. Now, given that the sort of men who use, you know, Viagra, Cialis, et cetera, often, you know, are at risk for heart attacks and other adverse health outcomes, because, you know, they might not be in the best of shape, or they might be heavy smokers, or they might be getting on in age,
yeah,
or whatever. This is probably more medically necessary than the actual requirement for an ultrasound for women having an abortion. But the rationale for this, you know, hey, if you're going to require, the state is going to require unnecessary medical procedures in order to make a political point, then let's
make men go through them too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, let's make sure that they're equally uncomfortable.
Yeah. Under the same law.
So legislation pops up in other states, say Washington State, I think that's a fine strategy to pursue.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of uncomfortable, Susan G. Komen.
Speaking of women's health issues, yes, this week Susan G. Komen for the Cure Breast Cancer Charity raised a ruckus when it announced it would stop sending funds to Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood uses about $700,000 per year of the Susan G. Komen's donations to screen low-income and rural women for breast cancer. Now, the official excuse given by the Komen Foundation was that their new grant criteria would ban grants to groups that are quote-unquote under investigation. Well, recently, Republican Representative Cliff Stearns of Florida began an inquiry into Planned Parenthood's use of federal tax dollars. He was trying to find out if they might be using federal tax money to fund abortions, which would be against federal rules. This is clearly...
But that's not a criminal investigation.
Yes, that's not a criminal investigation. And it's clearly sparked by anti-abortion extremists putting pressure on Planned Parenthood. After 3 days of protests by donors to the Komen Foundation, by women's health advocates, by even some of their own affiliates, local affiliates, saying that they would not follow the new rule, the Komen Foundation finally relented and they changed their criteria to say that they would ban donations only to organizations that are under criminal investigation. Now, I just want to read you a quote from their press release. This quote from their press release is as follows. We do not want our mission marred or affected by politics. Anyone's politics. Now, I just have to say, if that's really true, then they're living in a dream world, because women's health and healthcare in general in this country is very heavily influenced by politics. That's the very reason that the Komen Foundation exists, is because women's healthcare issues are not adequately taken care of in a country where we do not have universal healthcare. Now, the Komen Foundation...
And where much mm-hmm. of the funding and much of the political decisions are being made by men.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Komen Foundation, it gives a lot of money, as we just said, to Planned Parenthood for screening poor and rural women for breast cancer. Now, in a country where healthcare is not a political issue, that wouldn't be the case. They would not have to spend any money for screening. Screening would be done automatically. It would be covered by your government healthcare plan. It would be available to all women regardless of income. The Komen Foundation would not have to fund a cure. The government would be funding research into cures for one of the biggest killers of women in the United States. The Komen Foundation would exist to search for the cause of breast cancer, and right now that's not part of its mission. It's not even in the name of the foundation. The name of the foundation is Susan G. Komen for the Cure.
Yeah. There are several other items on that also. One, they were talking in their press release about not wanting to have this be a political issue. At the same time, they paid a good chunk of money to former Bush administration spokesperson Ari Fleischer to help advise them on PR for managing the media resulting from this decision. Well, obviously, he didn't give them their money's worth because they didn't do a very good job. But you don't hire a Bush administration official on women's health issues if you're not making a political decision.
Yeah. In addition, they hired Karen Handel, who as their VIP for public policy.
VP for public policy.
Her VP for public policy. After she lost her campaign for governor of Georgia, she was the Tea Party candidate for the governor of Georgia, and she was very, very vocal about her anti-abortion stance and often denounced Planned Parenthood. And so I look at those things and I say, if you guys are not interested in politics, why are you hiring these former politicians from the Republican Party? And in the case of Handel, an extremist from the Republican Party to deal with women's health care issues.
Yeah, and then another politically loaded item, and this one directly a product of the Seattle branch of the Komen Foundation. Were the folks responsible for marketing as one of the many consumer items that is marketed in pink for them to raise money? And that's, you know, there have been many other criticisms of the Komen Foundation also, one of them being their relentless consumerism in their raising
their
money.
Their ability to commodify an illness.
Yeah, and the fact that they have very, very high administrative overhead for a charitable nonprofit. It's well over 10%. Which is usually considered the benchmark. But other than that, the local branch of the Komen Foundation here in Seattle were the folks that gave us the pink handgun as a way to raise money for the cure. So you're going to support ending a disease that kills thousands of women a year by buying a product that kills thousands of women a year.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense, and it doesn't sound at all political to me.
Yeah. So let's move on.
All right. Super PACs.
Yeah, super PACs. This week, the campaign finance disclosure filings for 2011 with the Federal Elections Commission were made public, and a lot of press organizations started releasing information about them. It turns out that Republican primary funding has been most of the Republican primary funding has been done through super PACs, but most especially funding for Mitt Romney. About 60 corporations and wealthy individuals donated to just one super PAC for him that spent $17 million on advertising leading up to the Iowa caucuses. Now, that's an average of about $280,000 per donor to that super PAC. Many of the donors to that super PAC gave much more, and a few gave a little bit less. In addition, about that same super PAC spent about $30 million. They raised about $30 million in the second half of 2011 alone, and one of Romney's super PACs spent about $10 million in the 10 days leading up to the Florida primaries. That's $1 million per day.
Yeah, and I believe it was something like $44 a vote that Mitt Romney spent for the Florida primary. In other information on super PACs, remember, super PACs are a direct result of the Citizens United decision in the Supreme Court in 2010.
Decision said that unlimited donations by corporations and individuals can be made to these super PACs as long as the super PACs don't coordinate with the candidate's campaign, but they can still essentially campaign for the candidate as long as there's no coordination between the two.
Yeah. And the idea that there's no coordination, frankly, is a joke. But beyond that, there's also an enormous amount of Republican and corporate money that's queued up for the general election after the nomination for the Republicans is decided, despite the fact that President Obama set a record in 2008 for the amount of money raised in a presidential campaign. And most of that money, in fact, more of it, since he's now an incumbent, will be coming back to him this year. He is still, and the Democrats are still likely to be outspent this year, which is almost unprecedented for a sitting incumbent in the White House.
Yeah, and the difference really is where the money comes from. The Republicans, the money is coming from these super PACs, mostly from huge donors, very, very wealthy people. In the case of Romney, many of his supporters are financial industry executives, including hedge fund managers and executives at Goldman Sachs and Bain Capital, his former employer, but also big D.C. lobbyists. He was smacking Gingrich for taking lobbyist money for working for lobbying firms. But here Romney is taking millions of dollars from lobbyists through these super PACs, whereas Obama, he may have raised record amounts last year, but most of it came directly into his campaign, where donations from individuals are limited at $2,500 per person. That's not true for these super PACs.
Yeah, there's no limits on that.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, some interesting economic news this week. Let me just find my notes. Yes, the Treasury Department is investigating Freddie Mac for buying investments that would increase in value if, as long as Freddie Mac can keep homeowners from refinancing into lower interest rate mortgages. Now, this is pretty sleazy behavior, if you ask me. In 2010, Freddie Mac bought what are called inverse floater securities. Now, what are those, you might ask? Those are based on the interest-only portion of a bundle of mortgages. Now, what they do is they take a whole bunch of mortgages, put them into a bundle. They create a security called the inverse floater, which is just based on the interest paid on those mortgages. And they create other securities based on the principal, and they sell those off. Now, they didn't buy those inverse floater securities in order to diversify their portfolio. If they wanted to diversify their portfolio, they wouldn't buy anything tied to the housing market at all. They didn't buy them to hedge their huge mortgage portfolio. Again, they would buy something that would move in opposition to mortgages altogether. They bought them because these are profitable, and they're especially profitable if you are in control, as Freddie Mac is. You are in control whether or not home buyers can refinance into lower interest rate mortgages. And in that case, I think that is that's just egregious behavior. Also, in financial news this week, the New York Times had an article called "The SEC is Avoiding Tough Sanctions for Large Banks."
Yeah, that came out yesterday.
They analyzed SEC investigations over the past 10 years of large banks, and particularly fraud investigations. It turns out that the SEC has repeatedly let the biggest banks in the nation off the hook in potential cases of fraud, even after those companies have settled for violating the same rules. JP Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Bank of America are all on this list. They were granted exemptions so that these companies wouldn't lose the special privileges that they have in the financial markets. Now, they found that nearly 350 exemptions were issued over the last decade. About half went to repeat offenders who were violating the same laws over and over and over again. JP Morgan Chase, for example, settled 6 fraud cases in the last 13 years, but it also has been granted 22 exemptions. Bank of America and Merrill Lynch, which Bank of America now owns, were subject to 15 fraud cases, which they settled in the past decade, but they also got 39 waivers.
My favorite part of the J.P. Morgan Chase, by the way, was that they got those exemptions in part by arguing that it had, quote, a strong record of compliance with securities laws.
Yeah, and that's only because they'd been issued waivers over and over again in the past instead of being taken to court or being punished by the SEC by having their privileges taken away.
Even though they'd admitted to those violations to the Department of Justice and other
agencies. Oh yes, in other cases that they settled with the SEC, and the SEC didn't take them to court when they probably should have. Now, what are some of these privileges that they would have lost? Well, they would have, for example, they're able to get lower interest rates when they issue bonds because they're able to tell potential bond buyers, look, we're in compliance with all securities laws. Well, not necessarily true if the SEC is continually giving you waivers for violations of those laws. They can also instantly issue bonds without government approval, which they wouldn't be able to do if they were in violation of securities laws. They can also continue to manage mutual funds for investors and collect the fees on those management on that management work. They can also continue to help businesses raise capital, and they can collect fees from businesses for doing that. All things that they would not be able to do if the SEC actually aggressively pursued these violations.
All right. Moving on, Syria.
Yeah, Syrian government killed some 200 people in the city of Homs yesterday. Protests are getting more violent in Syria again over the past week. And by violent, we're talking not about the protesters, although that's happening too, but particularly the government in terms of its crackdowns. Now, a lot of the things that have been happening around Syria and the UN vote this week for being an example of it, diplomats saying that the Assad government is likely to fall, that it cannot continue with the pressure that it's undergoing, and that's being used as a rationale for not having more foreign intervention and not taking action by the international community as was done in Libya. However, Syrians within the country are saying that the government and the security forces there can hold out much longer than the foreign diplomats think it is, and that there's likely to have quite a bit more violence in the coming months while the Assad government holds on.
Yeah, and it's my understanding that part of the negotiations at the UN surround Russia, because Russia is a very strong economic supporter of Syria. There's a lot of trade between the two countries. Russia is unhappy about the idea of an intervention in Syria along the lines of the intervention in Libya. Of course, the Assad government would not want to have to flee the way Muammar Gaddafi fled. And the United States and France and Britain are proposing a solution in which the Assad family would leave the country the same way that Yemen's president has left the country, leaving the government in the hands of one of his deputies while he comes to the U.S. in order to get medical treatment and potentially to settle here. But the problem is, can they get the Assad government to agree to those terms, and can they find a country that will take Bashar al-Assad?
All right. That leaves us a few minutes for the many events we have.
Okay, yeah, we didn't have any last week, and we're making up for that this week. Let's start with today, where at noon there's the Leonard Peltier March going on in Tacoma. It'll be starting in Portland Avenue Park. That's Portland Avenue between East 35th and East Fairbanks down in Tacoma, going to the federal courthouse in Pierce County. That's at 1717 Pacific Avenue. So the march starts at noon, and the rally at the federal courthouse will be at 1 o'clock today. At 1:30 today, as part of a National Day of Action, a demonstration against potential war with Iran, either by Israel or by the United States, or both. That'll be at Westlake Center, followed by a march to the Military Entrance Processing Station at 2901 3rd Avenue in Westtown. That's sponsored by World Can't Wait, which has, you know, been waiting for several years now. Tomorrow, there's several events going on. Kasu Haga speaking on Kingian nonviolence. That will be at Bodell Hall in St. Mark's Cathedral on 10th Avenue in North Capitol Hill at 1 o'clock. Also at 1 o'clock, the 5th Annual Urban Poverty Forum will be taking place at Town Hall. That's at 8th and Seneca, just east of downtown. And at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, Bradley Manning, there'll be a support fundraiser for him, the accused WikiLeaks whistleblower. Speaking at that will be Jeff Patterson, the first public Gulf War resistor in 1990. That'll be held at the University Temple, United Methodist Church at 1415 43rd Street at 15th in the University District. And then on Monday, let's start with Rebecca McKinnon. She'll be talking on the struggle for Internet freedom. That'll be at Town Hall also, and $5, as is the Urban Poverty Forum on Sunday. And then there's Coffee Strong events on Monday and Tuesday.
Yeah, on Monday from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Coffee Strong, there will be a campaign to free Bradley Manning speaking event with Jeff Patterson, as Jav mentioned who that was a little bit earlier. The address for Coffee Strong is 15109 Union Avenue Southwest, Suite B in Lakewood. And on Tuesday...
And that's right off the exit 122 on I-5.
Yes, and on Tuesday at 2 o'clock and at 6:30 p.m. there will be showings of a film Grounds for Resistance, which is about the GI resistance movement, made one of the filmmakers is someone heavily involved with Coffee Strong. It's going to be at the Grand Cinema at 606 South Fawcett Avenue in Tacoma.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org is where you find Eat the State, with comics and news and blog items and all kinds of interesting stuff for you to check out.
And I've been posting my articles also on mariatomchik.com.